The first case on the court's morning calendar is Tawny McCroskey individually and as a natural parent for LM, a minor child, versus the Carson Tahoe Regional Medical Center, case number 70325. Council ready to proceed? All right. Good morning.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Peter Gurney and I have the pleasure to represent Tawny McCroskey. This verdict and the decisions leading up to it should shock the conscience of this court. During every aspect of this lady's pregnancy, she followed medical advice. She participated in prenatal training as directed by the mom's clinic. She presented to Carson Tahoe Hospital full term, carrying a normal, healthy baby boy. Every expert, every witness who testified on the subject would acknowledge that this baby should have been born normal. What happened? A review of the evidence reveals that she presented to Carson Tahoe Hospital as directed by the mom's clinic late in the evening hours. She was placed on the fetal heart monitor, as is customary, and for 9 hours, that fetal heart strip was normal. Normal variability, normal heart rate in the range of 135 beats per minute to 140 beats per minute. And then at 6:30, her water broke. And when her water broke, and when William descended in the birth canal, the cord was compromised. And from 6:30 on, Liam was deprived of oxygen. And so for the balance of his prenatal life, he struggled on oxygen reserves. And after approximately 15 minutes to 6:45, everybody in this case testified that this was an obstetrical emergency, that it was a case that had to proceed C-section. Indeed, when the shift changed, and when the nurses came on, some of the nurses came on at 6:45 and saw this fetal heart strip and saw what was happening, bells went off, and the downstairs downstairs operating room was activated. An additional physician, Dr. Arcangeli, was conscripted to handle this case. But notwithstanding every nurse's acknowledgement that this was now a Category 3 strip at 6:45, the worst of fetal monitor strips, notwithstanding their knowledge that this was an obstetrical emergency, they allowed themselves to be governed by the actions of Dr. Hayes, who, for unexplained reasons, basically said, no, we are going to deliver upstairs in the OBOR, in the obstetrical operating room, notwithstanding the fact that the obstetrical operating room was occupied by an obstetrical emergency, a mom with a retained placenta, notwithstanding the fact that Dr. Hayes had another laboring mother that she had to deliver, that she gowned up and gloved for. And so instead of delivering this baby at approximately by 7 a.m. or 7:12, at the latest, according to the testimony, this baby wasn't delivered until 7:45 or a little bit after that. The nurses knew that this was an obstetrical emergency. The plaintiff's experts testified that this was an obstetrical emergency. Even the defense experts acknowledged this to have been an obstetrical emergency. And yet, notwithstanding that, this mother was left to languish for over 45 minutes before the C-section was commenced. Well, how did this happen? It happened basically because of two mistakes, two grievous errors on the part of the court. First, the court ruled that Dr. Hayes, as a matter of law, was an independent contractor. In so doing, the district court ignored Schlotfeld and this court's holding there of the four typical factors to be considered by a jury. It ignored the words of this court, written by Your Honor, Justice Carragher, in Vandenberg, where you were presented with the question of non-delegable duty and defaulted, essentially, to the fact that we in this state have the issue of ostensible agency. And Judge Perigari wrote for the court, quote, a patient, it's a question of fact, quote, when a patient goes to the hospital and the hospital selects the doctor to treat the patient, this case. Notwithstanding the fact that the hospital chose the patient, and the hospital confuses that a little bit by saying, no, we didn't, this person medical group. Well, a patient should not be governed by the private dealings between hospital and doctor, of which she has no knowledge whatsoever. But in any event, they chose the doctor. Number two, she was under the reasonable belief that this was, that she was being treated by the hospital. Every aspect of her care up to that point had been provided by the hospital, given the fact that the prenatal clinic called the mom's clinic was a hospital-run clinic. Instead of allowing these factors to go to the jury, the court ruled that as a matter of law, the conditions of admission, arguably an adhesion contract, which the respondent does not reference in its brief, describes this doctor in very ambiguous terms as an independent contractor. It's a paragraph hidden in small type amongst multiple others. My memory is 16 others, but that document is in the record. And in it, it talks about several things. It talks about doctors being independent contractors, and the ambiguity within it is that it, of course, only talks about emergency room physicians, hospitalists, radiologists. It excludes obstetrics, assuming Connie had read it in the first place. But the point is, all of these facts are questions of fact for the jury to decipher. There is in the record also the testimony of Jenny Glover, the lady who secured Connie's signature on this document, and her very confusing testimony to the effect that she can't remember what she's told Connie, but she can, by custom and practice, tell us that agency and independent contractor, and she explained the two and confused them both. So all of that should be questions of fact left for this jury, but it was not. So to summarize that aspect, if this court were to agree with the defense that all a hospital has to do is describe a doctor as an independent contractor in a document, you will effectively eliminate the doctrine of ostensible agency in this state. It will be gone. Because they will write it down. There will never be an opportunity for a jury to consider whether it's a meaningful way to inform the patient that the doctor is an independent contractor and what that means. The ostensible agency theory, as a practical matter, will be dead, no longer available to Nevada patients. In an area where doctors are allowed to be or carry inadequate insurance, and now free from the risk of a derivative claim, hospitals won't have to be quite as concerned about quality of care.
I don't want to cut off the agency argument, but I do want to talk about Gamboni, 41A.045. Can you harmonize those?
Understood. Gamboni, the district court, in reliance on 41A.045, said that the settlement with Dr. Hayes defined the hospital's liability. And to rule otherwise would allow the patient or the plaintiff double recovery. Both are incorrect. First, we all know that cases are settled for many reasons. One, and oftentimes for inadequate compensation and not full value. Oftentimes because there's inadequate coverage, which was the case here. And then in the record, it is reflected that Dr. Hayes carried but a $1 million policy of insurance. Second, while 41A.045 is a concept of several liabilities, it does not exclude its fault for the vicarious fault of its employees or agents, just like it's not excluded for the fault of its nurses who are clearly employees. So whether someone is clearly an employee or appears to be an employee by virtue of the ostensible agency doctrine, the hospital remains vicariously responsible for that person's fault. Third, there is no double recovery. And the reason there's no double recovery is because under 41-245, I'm not very good at remembering.
045.
No,
you're good.
No,
go ahead.
41. Yes, you're right.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Like I said, in any event, that hospital is entitled to credits, or to use the legal term, offset, because it's responsible for the fault not only of itself on a direct claim, but derivatively for the conduct of its agent. In that circumstance, with regard to the fault of an agent, it's entitled to an offset. So there's no double recovery whatsoever.
Okay.
None.
Because the settlement agreement with the doctor doesn't define the whole of the doctor's liability.
It can't.
Okay.
It can't. And of course, if you ruled that it did, you would be defeating another very, very important aspect of the Uniform Act, which in Gamboni, Judge Zinoff emphasized, and that is the public policy of this state to encourage settlements. There would never be a settlement with a physician if that settlement was viewed as a definitive resolution of a vicariously responsible employer.
So in this context, though, the hospital would only be responsible for the doctor's negligence, the sum, the whole of the doctor's negligence, and entitled to offset, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct. Turning to the second reason why this jury...
Well, but is that really the case? There is a difference between contribution and indemnity.
Correct.
And when Gamboni was addressing the Uniform Act and making this determination, it recognized that indemnity exists, but there would be no claim for contribution. So I'm not sure that it's as definitive as you've suggested, that the hospital is entitled to a credit for the settlement received. The concern expressed by a majority of jurisdictions that have looked at this particular question about the influence of these recent statutes impacting healthcare providers' liability has addressed the issue about the impact on settlement where the settling party is still exposed as a result of a vicarious liability analysis consistent with what you have advocated. It's not entirely clear to me that in Gamboni that was evaluated one way or the other, and it certainly wasn't in the context of this statute because she didn't exist at the time Gamboni was decided. So if you were looking at this question today, as we are, and thinking about how an opinion would assess the impact or influence of the statute on this history of jurisprudence in Gamboni, how would you articulate that? Because it seems as though Gamboni has recognized the right of indemnity, but not the right of contribution.
I don't read it that way. Gamboni acknowledges the Uniform Act where two or more joint tortfeasors, etc., as the statute reads.
But an employer who is vicariously liable is generally not treated as a tortfeasor. They're liable by virtue of the respondeat superior doctrine,
correct,
which is quite different.
Well, in Gamboni, Gamboni Holmes was vicariously liable for the driver Alamesis's negligence.
Mm-hmm.
Vicarious liability was an issue in Gamboni.
Oh, certainly.
Yes.
But what they were addressing was the interpretation of the Uniform Act dealing with contribution and indemnity.
And whether the release of one tortfeasor released the employer and,
right,
and indicated uniformly that it does not. And in this case here, the release of the employee agent does not impact the hospital in the least because under 41-141, paragraph 3, they are entitled to an offset. They get a credit for that $1 million. They're benefiting by it, thus encouraging settlements. So I think that this is very, the position that we're advocating here is very consistent with Gamboni and the Uniform Act.
Can I ask you this as it relates to contribution and indemnity? The way I see contribution is more or less if there's fault independently on the hospital's part as opposed to indemnification, which I think fits more clearly into this situation. Go ahead.
I don't know what that means.
It means you're out of time, Mr. Durney, but you
15
may...
15 minutes is gone?
Yes, but please go ahead and respond to Justice Perry-Gary's question.
I'm sorry, Justice Perry-Gary.
We were just talking about contribution and indemnity, and do you see any distinction between contribution and indemnity as it applies to this situation? I see contribution more where there's independent liability on behalf of the other actual tortfeasor as opposed to responding to the superior as you got here.
Well, if I understand your question, Justice Perry-Gary, there are two claims here. One, that the hospital is vicariously responsible for the errors and omissions of Dr. Hayes, and secondly, directly responsible as a result of its own, errors and omissions of its nurses.
All right.
So we have a derivative claim and we have a direct claim.
Got it.
Yeah, and it's the derivative claim that was lost here when the district court essentially gutted our case by allowing or concluding that Dr. Hayes was an independent contractor as a matter of law.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
I didn't get the chance to address perhaps the second most significant prong or reason why this verdict was grossly unfair and shocking.
Why don't you, in a couple of sentences, wrap that up?
Can I? Just a couple. Well, let me say this. That there's a quote in this case. It's in the brief. And that is, Medicaid exists for a reason. Our government, our country, and our state take care of its own. That's why we have it. And we have heard that Ms. Bukrowski has incurred no out-of-pocket expenses, that all of his care and treatment that stands outstanding has been covered and will be continued to be covered in the be covered period. Our country and our state take care of its own. This case is so permeated with collateral source as to make it grossly unfair. And I know Judge Stiglitz has ruled, while a district court judge, that 42021 is preempted by federal law. The federal and the state law cannot coexist. There is no way you can avoid the constitutional principle of preemption in this case, leaving us with the per se rule. So I could say more, but I'm sorry I ran out of time. I thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Mr. Kelly?
Good morning. John Kelly on behalf of Respondent Carson Tahoe Regional Medical Center. The idea and the theory of ostensible agency is a joint liability theory. 45A.045 abolishes joint liability. When we look at ostensible agency in the context of a medical negligence claim, there should be no ostensible agency if the only liability on the part of the hospital is vicarious liability for the conduct of the doctor.
Because counsel just said that his separate theory was against the hospital also.
Correct. And that's the theory we tried, Your Honor. There were numerous theories against the hospital. There was the theory that the nurses did not go up the chain of command. There was the theory that the medical records were altered. There was a theory that the nurses did not participate in training to go up the chain of command. These were the issues that were tried for 10 or 11 days in the district court. And I have no objection to, and I think the law supports the fact that the appellant has the right to pursue those claims as against the hospital. But I think that 41A.045 that abolishes joint liability would also abolish vicarious liability on the part of the doctor, such that if the only claim for the hospital, hypothetically, is the ostensible agent conduct, the vicarious conduct of the doctor, that would fly in the face of 41A.045, which abolishes joint liability. The hospital would not be able to and should not be responsible for conduct of the doctor. I agree they're responsible for their own conduct, but I submit to you that that's very different from the vicarious liability that's derivative only from the doctor.
What is it about the statute, though, that changes Gamboni? I mean, Gamboni made clear that the employer is going to be liable for the acts of the settling employee, period.
Right. And I think the distinction, Your Honor, is that, first of all, Gamboni was 20 years before the statute came down. Secondly, this statute applies only to medical negligence cases. So I don't think Gamboni is disturbed except outside the area of medical negligence. And thirdly, I think what we're talking about is employer-employee responsibility. That's very different from ostensible agent. For example, in a healthcare environment, the nurses may be and usually are employees of the hospital. And under vicarious liability, it's almost strict liability for the hospital as it pertains to the conduct of the nurses. I think that's distinguishable from the conduct of the physician, who is not an employee.
No, but isn't the we appreciate they're not necessarily an employee, but the ostensible agency is to try to capture that piece where a person who comes in the hospital may believe they're an employee. I mean, that's that ostensible agency piece. Why wouldn't that still survive? Why isn't that a question of fact for the jury?
Well, I think it's not a question of fact for the jury in this case, because under the Oler case and also under the Schwabfeld case, it was decided that the court could find as a matter of law the absence of ostensible agency as opposed to the existence of it by finding one of the factors or elements that would not be sufficient evidence to go towards the jury to make that decision. In this particular case, the district court found that with respect to the notice requirement, that this patient was on notice, that the doctor was not an ostensible agent, based upon the facts, the multiple conditions of admissions that were signed, and I respectfully disagree with Mr. Durney, that particular paragraph is highlighted. It also is the only paragraph of 13 paragraphs that requires a signature or an initial, rather. And in fact, just recently in California, the court there decided Marco versus Rosner in 2016, 3 Cal. 5th, 1027, virtually the same facts, conditions of admission, where the hospital went out of its way to put it in boldface and require that the patient initial that particular paragraph. And I think in our particular case, that's exactly what happened. And I think it allowed the court to find as a matter of law under Oler and under Schlottfeld that the court could find as a matter of law that the there was not sufficient evidence to put this before the jury as a question of fact. So I don't believe that the court erred. And I would submit even further, even if this court feels that the district court erred in that regard, I think it's harmless error. Because in a medical negligence case, under this statute, 41A.045, I think it is inconsistent. If hypothetically this case went forward to a jury, and let's assume hypothetically that they find ostensible agency, that Dr. Hayes was ostensible agent of the hospital, and the hospital's only liability was vicarious liability based upon the negligence of the doctor, I would submit that that would be inconsistent with 41A.045 because there would be joint liability. The hospital and Dr. Hayes would both be jointly liable in violation of the statute.
But everybody would only be on the hook. The hospital will only be on the hook for the harm of the doctor, the one harm, correct? the jury would have to determine how negligent was what was the percentage of the doctor's negligence, how much is it? And the hospital is if they're vicariously liable, then they're in that mix and paying it. How does that make them a joint tortfeasor?
Makes them a joint tortfeasor. If the hospital is going to also be responsible vicariously for the conduct of the doctor,
right?
And the patient can recover against both. They're joint tortfeasors. They're both having to respond and pay. The hospital is going to be vicariously responsible for the patient. I think that's what the code section was designed to avoid, joint liability. And I also respectfully...
I think what we're trying to probe, though, is the issue of whether joint and several liability and vicarious liability are separate doctrines.
I think they are.
And if they are, then does the statute only address joint and several liability? It doesn't speak to vicarious liability. And if it doesn't, why wouldn't Gamboni apply?
Well, I think that Gamboni doesn't apply and the Uniform Act doesn't apply, because once liability, if it's solely derivative as a result of conduct of the doctor, then it has to be a joint recovery. It's not several. And I don't think there would be any way to identify what percentage of fault would be attributable to the hospital, especially if the hospital has independent acts of negligence that they're responsible to defend in any event.
Gamboni talked about that, and I might disagree with Mr. Durney a little bit about how you read Gamboni, but it seems to me that Gamboni is focused on the relationship of indemnity between the employer and the employee, not contribution. And as a consequence, I'm not sure that it is a joint liability result for the employer to be held liable, that a hospital to be held liable. Rather, it's an issue of indemnity that it seeks back against the employee.
Well, I think it's addressed also in Peruzzi in the context that there is no right to an offset. Mr. Durney pointed out that the party would be entitled to an offset.
That's an important point, because it relates to whether or not we're dealing with joint and several doctrines or vicarious doctrines. Peruzzi dealt with a joint and several liability distinction. It did not deal with vicarious liability.
I agree, and I think that vicarious liability is distinct and separate. And I think an example of that would be, it's almost like strict liability for the nurses. That's very different than strict liability for a doctor who is an ostensible agent. I think they are distinct, and I think they're different.
If ostensible agency was met, then would you still, let me back up. You don't agree that, you agree with the court, ostensible agency as a matter of law was not here. Let's say it was. For purposes of argument, it was proven that he was an ostensible agent. Why would the hospital be entitled to any different treatment in that context than they would be if it was their employee?
Because the ostensible agent is not an employee, and the result would be that the hospital would be vicariously responsible for the act of the doctor, which we're going back now to it, they're being jointly responsible. So it seems like it would be inconsistent to hold in that manner. The point that Mr. Durney made about the Medicaid issue, I'd like to address that briefly. First of all, I don't think that issue is really ripe for the court to address. We've spent many, many days talking about liability, causation. The jury never got to the issue of damages. There were multiple witnesses, multiple expert witnesses. Five nurses came in from Carson Tahoe, and frankly, we never got to the issue of damages. And the amicus brief suggests that this issue permeated the trial, and I would suggest that's not accurate. If you look at the record, even if you look at the closing arguments, my closing argument I read was 33 pages. It was probably 45 minutes long. The only reference I made to that issue was what Mr. Durney quoted in the entire argument. And Mr. Durney, in his closing, which I think was 45 pages, the only time he mentioned it had to do with they have a right for reimbursement. I have no objection to that. I think, though, that it wasn't ripe. It's not ripe to decide that issue because the jury never got to that issue. But even if it were ripe, I think that the ballot statement said that that is severable, and I think the district court analyzed it very carefully. And the code section allows for the admissibility of state and federal collateral source benefits, but the district court, I think, appropriately concluded that they still have their right for subrogation, and that was not lost. So I respectfully disagree with Mr. Durney on his argument as it pertains to the admissibility of the Medicaid. I don't think it really, the jury never got to that issue. There were a couple other issues with respect to Peruzzi that were raised in appellant's brief. Mr. Durney did not directly address those, but I would like to comment that I think the holding in Peruzzi is consistent and accurate and supports the statute 41A.045. As a defense attorney, I don't know how we could allocate responsibility. We could determine the several responsibility or the percentage of fault to defendants unless they're on the verdict form, and the court or the judge or the jury has the right and the ability to allocate responsibility and a percentage of fault for those defendants. And I think this suggests, as has been suggested, that a settling defendant is not a defendant is inaccurate and is nonsensical. The Restatement of Torts in 2000, they define a settling defendant as a defendant. And frankly, it wouldn't make any sense. We wouldn't have any way to assess liability, several liability, on the part of a settling party if they weren't considered a defendant. So I think actually the Peruzzi decision is appropriate. It is consistent with the law in the state. And I would respectfully disagree with appellant's arguments as it pertains to Peruzzi.
Mr. Kelly, there's some express language in the Schlotfeld case. And I wonder if you'd comment on how this court approaches the ostensible agency theory when that court, this court in that case, I should say, stated. The court further held that, quote, typical questions of fact for the jury include, and then there's four factors describing ostensible agency. Doesn't that case declare that this is an issue of fact, not an issue of law?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think in the Oler case, which Schlotfeld refers to, the court made a distinction that the court could find as a matter of law the absence of ostensible agency as opposed to the existence of ostensible agency, two very different things. And I think that the one of the factors or elements, this notice requirement, that the court, the district court in our case, just like in Oler or the Morkow case that I referred to earlier in California, could find as a matter of law that there was insufficient evidence to put that issue to the jury. When in a situation like this, you have a condition, you have a situation where the hospital, the conduct, the issue is the conduct of the hospital. Did the hospital act reasonably to put a reasonable person on notice that the doctor was not an employee? It's not so much whether or not the patient read the conditions of admission or even understood them. If that were true, everybody would simply say, I never read it, or I didn't get it, I don't understand it. I think the legal question is, did the hospital act reasonably under the circumstances to put a reasonable person on notice that this doctor is not an employee and you will be billed separately? And I think the district court in our case found appropriately as a matter of law that the evidence was clear on that point. It was insufficient to go to the jury to make a contrary decision. And I think at the end of the day, that the district court's ruling is consistent with Oler, and I think it's consistent with the court's statement in the Schlotfeld case, because the Schlotfeld case everyone knows, referred to Oler and made the distinction between the absence of an agency as opposed to the existence.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelly and Mr. Durney, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted.